Feeding the Flame by Tuesday Love Sang Grandpa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 3. The right path is close at hand, yet mankind searches for it afar. What is life like in Lhasa today? Are novices having their third eye opened? What has happened to all the people you describe in the first book? The Lhasa of 1970, under the terrorist rule of the Red Chinese, is very, very different from the Lhasa of the era before the Chinese invasion. People are furtive. People look over their shoulders before venturing to speak, even to the closest acquaintance. There are no beggars in the streets now. They have either been nailed up by their ears, or long since dead, or they have been sent to forced labor. Women are not happy, carefree people that they used to be. Now, in Chinese-dominated Tibet, women are forcibly mated with Chinese men who have been deported from China and sent to Tibet to be the first colonists. The Chinese are guilty of genocide. They are trying to kill the Tibetan nation. Chinese men were torn from their families in China and sent to Tibet to till the hard soil and to scrape a living somehow, sent to Tibet to mate with unwilling women and to be the fathers of a race of half-breeds, half-Chinese and half-Tibetan. As soon as the child is born, it's taken away from the parents and placed in a communal home, where it is taught, as it grows up, to hate all things Tibetan and to worship all things Chinese. Tibetan men are being dealt with so that they are men no longer, so that they can no longer be fathers. Many men, and many women too, have escaped, perhaps to India or perhaps to the higher mountain recesses where the Chinese troops cannot climb. The Tibetan race will not die out. The Tibetan race will continue. It is a tragedy that the high-ranking Tibetans now in India do not stir up interest in saving Tibet. At one time, I had the fond hope that some of these higher-ups would put aside their petty jealousies and petty hatreds, and they would have cooperated with me. I have long had the great desire to speak as a representative of Tibet before the United Nations. I am not dumb. I am not illiterate. I know the side of the East, and I know the side of the West, and it has long been my most fervent desire to serve Tibet by appealing to the free peoples of the world on behalf of the people now enslaved, now facing determined attempts to extinguish the whole race. But, unfortunately, I've been called many things, and those higher-ups living in comfort in India have not seen fit to do much about saving Tibet. However, that is another matter and is one man's ambition, an ambition, though, which is entirely unselfish, for I sought nothing for myself. My books are true, every single one of them. They are absolutely true, but, unfortunately, the press saw fit to attack me. After all, it's so much easier and so much more sensational for the press to try and pull down a person and try to make a blood and thunder tale out of something which doesn't exist than to admit the truth. It seems to me, looking back through the years, that those high-ranking Tibetans in India, now living there in considerable comfort, are afraid to support me in the mistaken idea that if they did so, they would lose the support of the press. Who cares about the press anyhow? I don't. People I have known in Tibet, the most highly placed of them, have been killed, tortured to death. For example, Tibet's prime minister was dragged behind a speeding car through the streets of Lhasa. A rope was tied around one ankle, and the other end of the rope was tied to the back of a car. The car was loaded with jeering Chinese, and off it started, pulling an eminent man through the streets, turning and twisting on the rocky road, tearing off his nose, tearing off his ears, tearing off other things until, raw, red, and soaking with blood, he was just tossed aside on a garbage heap for dogs to devour. Women whom I knew, well, their daughters have been publicly raped in front of their families as well. Many eminent women have been forced into brothels for Chinese troops. The list could go on long about such happenings, but there is no point in it. Certain cowardly men of high estate capitulated to the Chinese demands and became lackeys of the Chinese, obeying their every whim, aping them, fawning upon them, and remaining in positions of trust until their masters tired of them and liquidated them. Yet others escaped into the mountains to continue the fight against the Chinese. Many, of course, went to India. Well, that's their choice. But again, the thought comes, why would not the great ones, safely in India, do something to help those who were not safe? In the great temples and at the Patala itself, all the gold sheets forming the roof have been torn off and carried away to China, where, presumably, the gold has been melted down and made into money or something. Sacred figures have been melted down for their gold and silver content. Precious jewels have been removed and taken to China, and other things, books, manuscripts, paintings, and carvings have been tossed upon a great bonfire, and the whole lot burnt up, and with it the history of a harmless, innocent country devoted only to the good of mankind. Lamasseries are now brothels or barracks. Nunneries, well, the Chinese regard them as ready-made brothels. Ancient monuments have been torn down to afford easier passage for armored columns. Lhasa now is the capital city of terror, where people are tortured and killed without knowing the reason why. All that was beautiful has been destroyed. Unless alert men could save those things in time and painfully carry them off to the mountain refuges, where they would be stored for coming generations, all that was beautiful has been destroyed. Tibet will rise again. There is no final battle until the last battle, and only the last battle is decisive. Tibet will rise again. Perhaps there will be some strong man emerge who will be a great ruler. Perhaps he will revitalize those who have now merely sought safety and comfort in flight. Tibet is now ringed with great roads, great barrack-like buildings, housing workers who are trying to make some sort of order out of high, barren land. It is not a happy task, because the Chinese men, who have been forced against their own wishes to be immigrants or colonists, hate the land, hate the people. All they desire is to return to their own homes, to their own families. but the Tibetans are treated as subhumans. The Chinese colonists are treated as prisoners and kept in Tibet against their will, and any who try to escape are tortured and publicly executed. Meanwhile, the nations of the world go on about their own everyday business of having a few wars here and there, Korea, Vietnam, Israel, and the Arab countries, Africa, the Chinese-Russian border, and quite a few other places. But if there was a suitable voice, perhaps some of the more astute nations of the world would listen to a plea for help from an accredited representative of Tibet who could augment the spoken word by the written word, who could appear before the United Nations, who could appear on television, and who could write and write seeking aid for a stricken people before it's too late. From the corridor came a roaring like a town bull on double overtime. A crash at the door, and the outsized neighbor came striding in. Face flaming like the setting sun, he plunked down on a chair with a crash that seemed to shake the building. "Know what?" he bellowed. "Those in Halifax want to put up my rent." The old man, propped up in bed, tried to think of some good words to say about Halifax, but he had to admit that everything was going up. Milk, rent, postal charges, freight charges, the works. Downstairs, in the main lobby, the superintendent, Angus Robichaud, worked hard at cleaning the carpet. So much to do. Far too much to do and far too much responsibility. Angus Robichaud is a good man, a loyal man, and one who successfully treads the narrow path between doing what his employers demand and doing as much as he can for his tenants. A rare man of a type becoming increasingly hard to find. In the superintendent's apartment, his wife, Mrs. Robichaud, was fighting to preserve patience and sanity between conflicting telephone calls. Mrs. Schnitzelheimer of 1027 was calling bad-temperedly, "I want ze eat. You should turn off yes already. My husband, he say, he got fried on his skin. The eat, she is too much, yes?" No sooner had she hung up with a bad-tempered bang than the phone rang again. "Say, ma'am, you just tell your husband to turn up the heat a lot pronto, or I phone the boss and make a complaint. What you think I pay for here, eh, to be refrigerated?" Everything going up. The old man guessed that Mr. Robichaud's pay was not. What a pity, he thought, that some of these apartment building owners were so blind that they put a man in charge of a building that cost a few million to build and probably pay him hardly enough to keep body and soul together. Yes, prices were going up to make money for those who already had plenty. Pay, pay, the price of everything is going up. Yes, that's a good question. I am asked, why do occultists expect to be paid for giving advice, for information? It's wrong to charge for occult knowledge. All right, Mrs. So-and-so, you go along to your lawyer or your doctor or your food store, go anywhere you like, and if you expect something, you will have to pay for it. Your lawyer had to pay a lot of money for his training. He had many lean years as a student and as a graduate lawyer. He invested money and time in knowledge, specialized knowledge, and he expects, and rightfully expects, to have an adequate return on his investment. Your doctor also had many years of hardship as a medical student. He had to study, he had to walk the wards, and then he had to pass a severe medical examination to see how much he knew and how little he knew. If he's any good as a doctor, he's still studying, still keeping up with current developments, still reading about the results of research. He spent a lot of money on his studies, invested in the future, and like the lawyer, like a stockbroker, like anyone, he expects to get an adequate return on his investments. Try going to a local store and getting free groceries. Tell the storekeeper it's criminal for him to have so much food on his shelves while you have none on yours. Tell him that it's criminal, him with so much food and you with none, for him to charge you. Do that and you'll probably find yourself hustled off to the local mental home as being non compos mentis. The genuine occultist or metaphysician, and I am one, has spent a long time learning and suffering. As such, while we gladly do anything we can to help people, we still have the right to live, the right to eat, the right to wear clothes. As such, we make a charge. Ask your doctor, your grocer, or your lawyer if that's not correct. There is another question on the same letter. Perhaps we should deal with that at the same time. It is pertinent to the remarks above. The question is, I have been to Vancouver and I live in British Columbia. Beautiful BC. There is a man there who charges large sums of money for answering questions. He says he's a student of yours, and he works very closely with you, and you advise him whenever he's in difficulties. This man has taken a lot of money from me, and he has given me information which is completely and utterly false. What have you got to say about that? Well, in the first case, I'm not working with anyone. I have no students whatsoever. It is utterly false to say that I am working closely with any fortune teller. I don't believe in fortune tellers. Too often, if one fortune tells, one induces a person to do what he or she would not normally do. But we'll deal with that in a moment. If you have reason to believe that person is posing as a student of mine and that person is obtaining money from you by falsely pretending to be a student of mine, then all you have to do is go to the local police station and see someone in the local fraud squad. Explain things to him, and if you like, you can show him this book. Show him this page where I state most definitely that I have no students whatever, and I do not work at all with fortune tellers or anyone of that ilk. Tell him also that I have no disciples. I do not want disciples. Actually, they're a darn nuisance. But, of course, that's between you and me. Disciples bumble around. Yes, master this, and yes, master that. They get underfoot. They creep out from the woodwork like termites. So many, many years ago, I decided I would never have students, and I would never have disciples. And all this makes your fortune teller in Vancouver, B.C., sound a bit silly, doesn't it? No, madam, don't blame me for false information. I give none. I don't even sell any. I write my books, and here again, you have my positive, my definite statement that all my books are true. I wouldn't swear it on a stack of Bibles because I'm not a Christian, and that would not mean any more to me than swearing on a bundle of old newspapers, but I repeat, all my books are true. It's unwise, you know, to bother with fortune tellers. After all, each and every one of us comes to this earth as students to a school. Now, supposing you went to college, and during a vacation or half day off, you puttered over to some old biddy who probably wears great big earrings and a scarf over her head, and you said, in effect, "Hi, Biddy, what am I going to do next term? I won't tell you anything. You tell me everything." Well, the old biddy couldn't tell you much, could she? She wouldn't know what course you were taking. She wouldn't know what your secret ambitions were or what your weaknesses were. No, and the average fortune teller is much like that. Now, read this carefully. Get it engraved on your memory. No human can consult the Akashic record of another human without divine permission. And you can take it that divine permission is rarer than hair on an egg. So, if people say they're just going to buzz off for a moment and have a look at the Akashic record and come back with the blueprint of your past life and your future life, just tell them what you think. And if you're wise, just call in the fraud squad if any money is involved. Every one of us is here to do something, and if we listen to fortune tellers who do not really know what they are telling, then we might be sidetracked, and instead of making a success of our life, we may be heartily disillusioned, discouraged, or disenchanted. The best thing is to meditate properly, and if you do that, you can know an awful lot about yourself, and usually it is quite awful. You see things where you have gone wrong through listening to others. Of course, you can listen to others, but you have to make a choice yourself and go your own way with full responsibility for yourself. One of the most foolish statements ever made is to the effect that no man is an island unto himself. Silly, isn't it? Of course everyone has to be an island unto himself. If you join cults and groups, then you are not being an individual, you're just being somebody living in a community. If you become a member of a cult or a group, you are not accepting your responsibility as an individual human. No doubt this will cause a considerable uproar amongst all those people who advertise metaphysical correspondence courses where you pay high sums for life and you get little back. But the whole truth is this: no matter what your mother told you to do, no matter what your group leader told you to do, or the high mystical holder of the symbolic key of the correspondence college, when you pass over from this life, you and you alone have to answer to your overself for what you did or for what you did not do. It is utterly futile for you to think that you can say, "Oh, you can't blame me for that. I only did what my mother told me to do. If she were here, she'd tell you so herself." But that is idiotic. You have to take the responsibility, and you alone. So, if you have to take the responsibility, and you most certainly have to, why, then, allow yourself to be persuaded to do something by a gang of people who are out to get your money or out to get a bit of power through heading a group? That type of person is not going to stand by you when your overself is judging your life. Again, let me repeat, you and you alone have to answer to your overself, so you and you alone should live your life and make your decisions and accept or reject responsibilities just as you and you alone think fit. It is useless to listen to Mr. Doug Walloper, the president of the Hog's Tooth Metaphysical Society, who will tell you this and tell you that and tell you something else, and who will tell you that if you do as his cult suggests, you'll get a reserved seat in heaven with a free harp, playing lessons thrown in. You won't know. If Mr. Doug Walloper knew enough, he wouldn't be talking such a lot of bilge. He would be so busy trying to clear up his own life and preparing for his own judgment that he wouldn't meddle with your responsibilities. In the same way, it is stupid to be swayed or influenced by those old women of both sexes who prate and yowl that you should join their religious group, telling you how damned you will be if you don't, telling you how wonderful you will be if you do join them. Well, again, remember that all these people will not answer for you later. Too many people bleat about God's blessing be upon you. They come pretending that they have direct authority from God to bless one and to give one absolution for things already done. Well, God must be awfully busy. These people are just the same as you, and you, and you, and no better, perhaps no worse. They might be deluded. They might think that because they wear their collar the wrong way round, or because they've read a book, that they automatically have become a saint. Having a knowledge of metaphysics does not necessarily make one spiritual, you know. According to legends, old Satan himself knows quite a trick or two in the metaphysical line, but you are not going to call him spiritual, are you? Not in the right way, that is. To come down to brass tacks, anyone can learn metaphysical things. It doesn't matter how bad the person, he or she can learn such things. He doesn't have to be of a certain degree of spirituality first. But a great and merciful providence nearly always, not always, but nearly always, arranges matters so that, if we get a double-dyed villain studying metaphysics, he changes verse to a once-dyed villain, and some of the dye washes out. He might even be a decent fellow beneath. But don't believe all the advertisements about the saintly so-and-so who is now a swami. A swami is a mister, do you know that? It's no mystical title. That little word swami really carries weight with a lot of people, but don't you be fooled by it. Now, I see there is another question here, which really we have just answered. The question is, tell me why people shouldn't do metaphysical things in groups, but should do it alone. I have already answered that, but perhaps I can add to it. A short time ago, I was sent some literature from a group who wanted me to join them. They boasted about their vast classes who were all meditating together. Did you ever read anything more stupid than that? Who were all meditating together? Well, if they had a scrap of metaphysical knowledge, they would know that you can't meditate together. Do you know why? Every human radiates energy, radiates waves. waves of thought, waves of prana, and everyone is, to some extent, telepathic. So, if you get a whole group of people all meditating about their own affairs, well, they certainly do gum up the works, and it is impossible to do any worthwhile meditation for oneself when one is in a group. You get the same sort of thing in big crowds. Take a football crowd, for instance. Here you get a few thousand normal people, some of them fairly well balanced, some of them as crazy as coots, and they all congregate together. They're thinking about the game, and then something happens. Someone thinks a certain thing and says a certain thing, and here in this crowd, you get a sudden group personality. You get mass hysteria. People get trampled underfoot. Immense damage is done to the football ground buildings. Seats collapse. People come storming out through the gates, yelling and shouting and roughing up anyone in their path. And later, when the crowd breaks up, the responsible ones feel quite dreadful, and shamefacedly they wonder whatever happened to them. The same thing happens in group meditation. Everyone thinking on a certain thing can cause the law of reversed effort to take place. I said, thinking about the same thing. The mere fact of meditation, of meditating, is enough, because if one is meditating, then it is a definite act, and every person meditating adds his or her own grain to the newly formed thought form or group personality. And unless there are some highly trained people, and there rarely are, who can control things, you get all sorts of nervous illnesses resulting from the meeting. So again I say, if you want this to be your last life on this round, do not join groups or cults. Live your own life, accept your own responsibilities, make your own decisions. Oh yes, by all means, consider the advice of others. Consider advice, weigh up the different advice you get, and then decide for yourself. Then when you have left this earth and you are in the Hall of Memories with your knees knocking together with fright, and you get the judgment of your overself upon your sins of omission and commission, you might get a few words of praise for yourself, and you might come out thinking, yes, yes, I'm glad I followed Lobsang Rampa's advice. He was right after all. With the closing of the day, the family were gathered about the old man's bed. Miss Cleopatra was looking out at the ships in the harbor. Miss Tadalinka was sitting on the old man's lap. Ma put down the first pages of the typescript which she had been reading, and almost simultaneously Buttercup put down the copy which she had been reading. "Well," queried the old man, "what do you think of it?" Ma rubbed her ear and said, "It's all right. It made me laugh, so that should be test enough." "And how about you, Buttercup? What did you think about it?" the old man said. Buttercup, well, she looked down at the typescript again and then looked up at the old man as she said, "You repeat yourself, you know. That bit about metaphysicians getting paid, well, you said something like that before in Beyond the Tenth." "But sure I repeated myself," said the old man in some exasperation. "How do I know if the person who is reading this book has read Beyond the Tenth? And these things, to my mind, are so important that surely a repetition is justified. After all, if you go to school, the teacher doesn't say a thing just once and expect you to have it forever after and 3 days, does he? He repeats it. Ma broke in, almost as if to prevent a fight. You say about no disciples, about not being interested in anything. How about John? The old man remembered his blood pressure, remembered his various complaints, and sat gamely on his safety valve, if bodies have safety valves. But anyway, he suppressed, as so often of late he had to suppress, the various comments which rose almost unbidden. All right, we'll make an exception about John. All right, we'll clear up one or two things which you say are not adequately covered so far. So, here goes. Every so often, one comes across a man or a woman who has a deep urge to obey spiritual impulses and to improve the nature and show that karma can be overcome. Such a person is John Henderson. We are very fond of John Henderson. Oh, let me qualify that. His hobby is acting, and he's a very good actor, except when he tries to act the role of an Irish priest. His Irish accent is more like the Bronx in New York. But that, though, is a digression. John Henderson is a good man who is trying and succeeding. I have suggested to him, most strongly, that later, when he's a bit older, he starts a spiritual retreat, so that he can help those who need help. He won't be telling fortunes. He won't be trying to delude anyone. Instead, as a truly spiritual person, he will be trying to help. So perhaps, in 3 or 4 years, you will be reading about John Henderson, in the best way, of course, that's understood. Buttercup said, "But how does metaphysics help people to be more spiritual? You say that anyone can study metaphysics, and usually even the bad ones turn good when they study metaphysics. So how?" Well, before the communist takeover in Tibet, there were various inscriptions carved on the lintels of lamasery entrances, such as 1,000 monks, 1,000 religions, or "The saffron robe does not a monk make." Unfortunately, there are many errant fakers and phonies in occultism. So much is hard to disprove, and so much appeals to what people want to know. Some of the bums who study metaphysics, or pretend to study metaphysics, gather a little knowledge and then act as if they were gods who know everything plus. Actually, most of these people really are just that, ignorant bums and nothing more. They are not truly studying with the intention of progressing. They are not truly studying with the desire to help others. They are trying to get a fast-talking smattering of occultism so they can make a fast buck. They are just pursuing a cult or even trying to start a fresh cult. They set out with a gang of so-called disciples, and then they perpetrate all sorts of spiritual crimes. They lead people astray, and they divert people from what should be their real task. At the present time, within the past very few years, a great horde of people have come on the scene, people whom one could justifiably call the great unwashed. Most of them are not merely unwashed, they stink with it, physically and spiritually. They seem to take a pride in wearing tattered rags of clothing, and they even take a greater pride in being uncouth and coarse. Well, uncouth is being coarse, isn't it? But anyway, they are uncouth, and they are also coarse with it. Let me tell them, as I so often tell them in letters, that there is no virtue in being dirty. In fact, with many of them I would like to get busy with a pig scraper and remove the first few layers of dirt to see what's really beneath. Now, for that question from Buttercup as to why people should study metaphysics, in studying metaphysics, they're just getting back what should be a birthright. Metaphysics has a scruffy name, but that is because scruffy people have abused the name. Actually, in years gone by, everyone had metaphysical ability. That is, everyone was clairvoyant and telepathic, but through abusing those powers, they lost the ability. The ability atrophied. You get the same sort of thing with a person who has had to stay in bed a long time. If a person is confined to bed and not permitted to exercise the leg, then the person loses the power of walking, forgets how to do it, and when the illness which caused the poor wretch to stay in bed has been cured, he or she has to be taught to walk all over again. A person who has been born blind and suddenly, through some advance in science, has been given sight, has to be trained in the art of seeing, because when you see for the first time, you cannot comprehend what it is you are seeing. One has to be taught to see things in 3D. One has to be taught to be able to judge distances. On this I have much personal experience, because I have been blind, and recovering sight suddenly is quite a shock. So, people study metaphysics so that they may regain powers which their ancestors had and lost. And how does metaphysics help even bad people become less bad and more spiritual? Easy. When one studies metaphysics, it actually raises a person's vibrations. And the higher a person's vibrations are, the more spiritual he becomes. So if a real thug suddenly has a change of heart and starts to study metaphysics, the mere act of studying occult knowledge makes him a better man while reducing his value as a thug. End of chapter 3.